Morning, everybody. I'm Don Landis. I'm an alcoholic. First things first, I want to thank Akron Founders Day for rolling my socks up and down, knocking me off my feet, filling my spirit up with what Alcoholics Anonymous is really about. I've had a fantastic weekend. Thank you. I want to thank my dear friend Joyce for the invitation to participate this weekend. My magnificent host, Jerry, and his vastly superior wife, for all their kindness. And of course, I'd be remiss if I didn't thank my favorite road dog, my beautiful wife, Eileen, 26 years sober, the best human being I know, who tagged along this weekend and kept me in line. We got to go to all the sites, didn't we, baby? And, now we got a picture of Dr. Bob sitting in the kitchen with those silly coffee cups and, you know, got the tear rolling down the eye, and that's going to be in our living room and our mantle, and people are going to go, where's that? We're going to go, if you don't know, it doesn't matter. If you were really in AA, you'd know. And I want to thank all the other speakers that participated this weekend. You've done a magnificent job of carrying the message to me. One of the advantages of getting to come to wonderful events like this is I get to sit out there with you and I get to listen to these great talks. Because I've been in AA since September 16th, 1991, and 27 years sober. I've been sponsoring it. Thank you. Thank you. We all understand we're applauding for AA. I mean, trust me, it had very little to do with the raw material I brought to the game. But I've been sober 27 years, been actively sponsoring men since I was 6 months sober, always had a home group, always been sponsored, no time off for good or bad behavior. I'm a meat and potatoes, card-carrying AA member. I've been around here, I've been had my eyes open. I've been watching you, I've been watching what you do and what you don't do, because I'm like every other alcoholic, you know, I'm a voyeur, you know what I mean? We're all watching each other trying to figure out what we have to do to survive this thing called alcoholism, you know, and some of us take the wrong approach to that. We're trying to see how little we can do and still survive. Not a good plan. Figure out what they tell you to do. Do a little bit more than that. You know, stack the deck in your favor. Because, you know, the game we play around here is you bet your life. And so I'm so grateful I got to come here and have the message carried to me. Because with all I know about AA and all my experience in AA, there's one thing I've never been able to do effectively. I can't carry the message to myself. And if I could carry the message to myself, well, I'd be home in Bellingham, Washington, carrying the message to myself, making my wife nervous as I recited chapter 5, walking through the kitchen. I don't know. So to be able to come here and have you do that for me means the world to me. And I'll tell you, I have no real explanation of why I'm an alcoholic, but I'll tell you this. I love drinking. I used to drink. I drank a lot, and I swore I'd never stop doing it. I would have told anybody that had the interest to listen that why would I? It's magic in a bottle. It transports me to the land of I don't care. Because long before I drink, I'm that goofy kid growing up like we all identify with. Like everybody else got the rule book but us. You know what I mean? I'm a dime late and a dollar. I'm a dollar late or a dollar short and a day late. You know what I mean? I'm a half a bubble off a plum. I don't know if I was born alcoholic, but I know I was born weird. You know what I mean? Just a little off, where people would come to our house and they'd meet me, you know, family members and friends of my mom, they'd meet me and they'd pull my mom aside and they'd go, boy, he's different, isn't he? And and I don't know if I'm born alcoholic, but I got all that alcoholic stuff going on, that I'm selfish, I'm self-centered, I'm self-obsessed, I'm not much, but I'm all I think about, you know? I'm that guy that'll get you in a corner and trap you with no escape. And talk incessantly about myself for 20 minutes straight. Finally realize I'm doing that, snap out of it and go, wait a minute, that's entirely enough about me. What do you think of me? And I mean, that stuff doesn't go away. You know, I was here earlier, you know, and the room's filling up with people. And one of the things I like to do in a big room like this is I'll just get off by myself and I'll close my eyes. And I'll listen to the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everybody talking, nobody listening, you know. I started drinking drunk when I was 17 years old, and it was free. I didn't pick up a tab. I didn't get in any real trouble. And when trouble entered my story and I started crashing cars and going to jail and breaking hearts and breaking promises, when I became the kind of guy that couldn't look myself in the mirror because I know I wasn't raised that way, when I took all of God's gifts and the potential that I was given and I rolled it up, pushed it up the hill of life, and the best I could do was tear my life apart with alcohol, when that trouble came into my life, it was no big deal. Because if you're an alcoholic and you're going to go the distance with your alcoholism, you can't let a little thing like looking bad slow you down now, can you? And my alcoholism will keep pace with the consequences of the actions I take when I drink. And it gave me the two best friends a drinking drunk will ever need, justification and rationalization. And what does that look like? You got to be able to go to jail, and when you get out, to face the people that love you the most and want the best things in the world for you, you got to look them right in the eye with no hesitation, go, well, everybody goes to jail once in a while. No, they don't. I've been sober a long time. It's shocking how many people I've met that have never been to jail. Here, let's do this for fun. How many people in this room have been handcuffed? Oh, my God. I need to point something out to you. That doesn't happen at Rotary. And around here, it's normal. You know what I mean? We got being arrested experts around here. Why? Because our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Becomes normal for me to be broke every Monday. Normal to have to put the pinch on somebody for $20 so I can drink that night. Normal not to pay my rent, not to show up at the family events, go to jail, not have a valid driver's license. You know, we just lower the bar. We see guys ahead of us in the game, and we see them take actions. We go, man, if I ever get that bad, I'll quit. And then we do it, and we go, well, it all makes sense now. Because I'm an alcoholic. I'm the real deal. I'm not a social drinker. I'm not a heavy drinker. Let's agree, if you go to jail in a blackout in Rancho Cucamonga, California, naked, that ain't social drinking. And that's not a story you can tell in polite society. People will clutch their children to them. They will leave the room. They will start their vehicles and leave. But I know something. There's probably 10 people in here that went, I done that. Because we all know that every whiskey bottle should have a disclaimer on it, right? Clothing optional. I mean, I don't know what it is about drunks and whiskey, but, you know, we just get warm. We, you know. Good Lord. Yeah, it's all fun and games, but I'll tell you what, it didn't end up that way. I took all that ability, all those blessings, good grades in high school, graduating class athlete. You know, you read my high school yearbook, it's all the great things I'm going to do and be. But by 19, I'm drinking drunk. By 25, I'm in a lot of trouble. By 25, I get the gift of self-knowledge where I know the drink is killing me. And it felt powerful. I felt like I knew something. I felt like now I understand, because they've been talking to me for years about my drinking, but now I'm going to be able to quit. And I made it 2 weeks under my own steam. And what started for me was a six-year odyssey before I made it to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, doing everything you read about in Chapter 3, vain attempts to control and enjoy my drinking, brief periods of recovery, followed always by a still worse relapse, a feeling I was regaining control, to find out I had lost even more control. You know, just when you think it can't get any worse, what does it do? It gets worse. And I pulled a big geographic, and I moved to Boston because I'm living in L.A. That's where I was born and raised, and I think that's my problem. And then I find out they drink in Boston. You know what I mean? And I take me with me, you know, and I hang out in Boston for as long as I can take it, which is 3 years, you know. And I come back to L.A., man, and I get the best job I ever got in my life a week after getting back to L.A. And, I mean, I'm not talking about my best job, you know, drinking. I'm talking my best job to date. Because alcoholics, we're phenomenal. We are like a cat flung outside a second-story window. And we will land on our feet, boom, in a three-piece suit at a job interview, you know. And we'll get the job. We'll get the job, we'll get the money, we'll get the girl. We just can't keep any of it, can we? I got fired from that good job for my drinking. Shocking, I know. I called up my sister in Simi Valley, California, and I played the victim card. Pat, they fired me after all I did for them. And she said, Don, you can come to my house and get on your feet, but if you drink, you're out of my house, because everyone knows I'm a drunk by this time. And I told my beautiful sister, Patricia, who I love as much as anyone on the planet, I won't drink, I promise. And when I said it, I wasn't lying, I wasn't in denial, I wasn't in delusion. You got to understand that was my truth at that moment. I absolutely did not want to blow that opportunity. I did not want to do to that family what I was about to do to that family. But I didn't understand there's no room for the truth where the game alcoholism is played. And I drank every day in that house for 6-7 months before I got sober. And if you don't know how you do that when they're watching you, maybe you're not a sneaky rat like I am. Because I got no problem drinking around your schedule. I'm unemployed. What time do you go to work in the morning? 7 a.m., bars open. And this is the end of my drinking. This isn't the drinking so I can kid myself I'm better looking than I am. This isn't so I can think I'm tougher than I am. This is oblivion drinking, light switch drinking, get the whiskey on board hard enough and fast enough to shut off the head. So you can push out all that terror that your life has become, all that failure, all that heartache, all that guilt, all that shame, all that remorse. Push it down with enough whiskey so you can black out. So you can come to in a room you're mooching off your family to face the hideous four horsemen. Terror, frustration, bewilderment, despair. They sat and they waited for me to come to, and they talked to me in my own head, in my own voice. They asked me questions. They made statements. Who are you going to rip off today, Don? Who are you going to hurt today? Taking every good thing that's ever come your way and you've torn it to shreds, and now you're ripping your family off and now you're breaking their heart. How's it going to end for a guy like you, Don? And I don't know what you do when your head talks to you like that on a hangover morning, but I just took another pull off the jug because you see, I had surrendered. And it's not the kind of surrender we ask our new friends to make in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the surrender of a broken alcoholic who doesn't have the will to fight any longer. I'm so tired. I've been fighting to drink for 5-6 years straight. Every day I wake up and I say, please God, not tonight. I just can't do it tonight. I wasn't raised this way. I'm dying and I know it. And that night I find myself drunk. I knew all about powerless long before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I walk up to my brother-in-law. I get an unemployment check from the state of California. And I said, Larry, can I borrow your car? He asked me a funny question. He said, Don, will you be coming back this time? And it was a fair question because I had borrowed his car a few times that summer and got out on little alcoholic excursions. We all know what those are. And our 12 and 12 tells me my outstanding characteristic is defiance. And when Larry said that to me, I got right in his face. I said, Larry, how dare you? You know, the last time this happened, Larry, I apologized. You know, I opened my heart to you, Larry. I don't really need this crap. And Larry, untreated Al-Anon that he was, took the keys out of his pocket. And I snatched the keys from this man who I'm mooching a room off of in his house to go get in his car. And I remember thinking, well, there better be gas in it. I went down to the liquor store to cash my unemployment check, because that's where alcoholics of my type cash their unemployment checks. And while I'm in line, I have what our book refers to as the thought that precedes the first drink. And for me, it sounds like this. What's in a half pint? Nobody ever went to jail between a half pint of whiskey. And so I got the half pint of whiskey and I drank it. It went so well, I got another half pint. I drank that. And I remember thinking, I can visit those friends in the valley. I'll be back in 45 minutes. They won't even miss me, and I am gone. 3 days later, I'm driving up the hill to face that family I'd done over one more time. One more time, I've taken their hope, their faith, and their trust, and I've torn it to shreds. And at that moment, I love them no less than I love them at this very moment. And I love my family tremendously. But I can't serve two masters. I only got time to serve one, and that's King Alcohol. You get between me and a drink, it's nothing personal. It's almost businesslike. I'm getting to the drink. I'm going around you, through you, manipulating you, lying to you. But the problem is, I don't understand what I suffer from. I'm bringing a knife to a gunfight. I don't understand what it means to be alcoholic, not truly. So I can't warn you, can I? I can't say, look, I didn't mean for this to happen. I love you with all my heart, but bet your bottom dollar it's going to happen again. I'm going to look you right in the eye, and I'm going to make sweet promises, but I can't keep them because I feel like a puppet on the end of the string. I feel like I'm possessed, like someone else is calling the shots. You got to get away from me. You got to save yourself. But I can't warn you because I don't know what I suffer from. So the family's confused and baffled, and I'm confused and baffled, and what I'm left with is sweet apologies that add up to nothing. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean for it to happen. Can you give me another chance? And it got hard for my family, my friends, and my employers, and the world in general to give me the second and the third and the 30th chances when I roar through the world like a tornado year after year. I walk into a house that's been devastated by the disease of alcoholism to find out an argument had broken out between my sister and brother-in-law in my absence. My brother-in-law wanted to report the car stolen, and my sister negotiated him down to a missing persons report. And the police were on their way up to do the follow-up work. Now, I don't know if you've ever been up for three straight days drinking, but the cops usually aren't who you want to talk to. I had warrants at the time for my arrest in two separate counties because I'm an overachiever. So I start screaming at my sister, you know I got warrants. I'm going to jail. Thanks for nothing, because now it's her fault. I go outside to wait for the police because I don't want the interview to go on in front of the family. I do not know what I'm going to be saying, but I'm fairly certain I'll be lying. And while I'm outside waiting for the cops, smoking a cigarette, sitting there thinking about how horrible my life is, and here they come, black and white, right up the hill. And on the side of the black and white, it says, canine unit. And I remember thinking, oh good, they brought the dog. Like I'm in any shape to make a run for it. And the cop got out, he started doing what those trained professionals do, asking you those tough questions like, where were you? Everything I remember is illegal, so I'm lying, and he's locking eyes with me, and I don't like that, so I break his gaze. Now he breaks with me, so now we're interviewing and dancing, and I do not feel good. And I'm looking for anything to distract his attention, and I see the dog in the back seat, and I go, hey, is that your partner? And he goes, well, yes, it is. And he walks over and opens the door, and this dog gets out, German Shepherd, not a hair out of place. Like a Rin Tin Tin reincarnate. And with no prompting on my part, he started to relay facts to me about the dog's life. The dog's past mandatory retirement. They can't retire him. He's too good. The dog has participated in more arrests than any dog in the history of Ventura County. The dog has participated in more arrests and rescues than any dog in the history of Ventura or Los Angeles County. This dog was so phenomenal that the officers took a collection out of pocket where they sent him over to Europe for international competition, where he kicked butt on German Shepherds, right? Right. And I said to the policeman, I said, man, that's a phenomenal dog you have there, sir. And this thought flew in the back of my mind. The kind of thought, the minute you think it, you know it's the truth. You want to deny it, but you know it's true. And what was true is this dog had done significantly more with his life than I'd done with mine. I hated that dog. I didn't know if that was going to be my entrance into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did not come to AA to get sober. I want to be very clear about that. I had proven to myself that I can want sobriety, I can want to be sober, but it's not going to happen because I have a horrible secret. And it's not the tough guy stuff I did in the bar, and it's not those things I'm going to take to my grave. My horrible secret is I absolutely hate the way I feel when I'm sober. And it's shameful and it's embarrassing in light of what I do when I drink. Of all the pain I cause myself and other people, all the lying, cheating, and stealing I do behind my drinking, it's embarrassing and shameful to admit that I just can't stand the way I feel when I'm sober. Little did I know I was soon to join a society of people that knew exactly how I felt. As Bill wrote in the Big Book, how darkest it is before the dawn. But I begged for another chance because my family wanted me gone, and I don't know where it came from. I said, please, you can't throw me away. You can't kick me out. I got nowhere to go. I'll go to AA and everything. To this day, I have no idea why I said that. And it's not like my family believed I was going to go to AA. I mean, my first week in AA, my sister drove me to Alcoholics Anonymous and drove me home from Alcoholics Anonymous. You know how that makes you feel when you look the way I look and you get in your older sister's compact car at the end of an evening of Alcoholics Anonymous? She's driving her 31-year-old loser brother back to her house. So, Donald, what'd you learn in AA tonight? You know, just... I do not remember my first night in AA. They assure me I was there and entertaining, but I was detoxing pretty hard. I was suffering from audio and visual hallucinations, but I do remember my second night in AA because it was... To this moment, it's been the most important night of my life. You see, I attended the 6 o'clock meeting at the Simi Valley Alano Club. It was an hour and a half long. There was a break between 7:30 and 8 o'clock, then the 8 o'clock meeting would start. So I'm waiting for the 8 o'clock meeting to start, and that night I did not look the way I looked this morning. I got my back against the wall, and I got greasy hair down in the middle of my back because I don't shower anymore. I got a full beard with food stuck in it. I've lost the ability to speak the King's English. I communicate in a series of hand gestures, grunts, and clicks. I'm wearing my sunglasses at night. I got my arms folded across my chest like so, and I'm rocking back and forth in Simi Valley Alano Club. And I'm not doing this because I'm a tough guy. I'm doing this because I feel like I'm going to explode from the inside out because I'm detoxing hard from alcohol, and I'm physically addicted to that beverage. And every molecule of my body is screaming, let's go get a drink. And the people in the Simi Valley Alano Club are giving me a wide berth because I am dangerous, because I am terrified. And anybody terrified is dangerous. And my head starts talking to me. Look at them, Don. They're clean and they know each other and they're happy to be here and they're not talking to you. And what are you doing, Don? What are you doing? You're quitting drinking, Don. Oh, again? How many times, Don? 1,000? And then what do? Don, you take the pain for what? 2, 3 days? 4 days? Maybe a week? And then what do? You drink again. Here's an idea for you, Scooter. Why don't you bypass the pain? Let's go get a drink. Let's get out of this pop stand and let's go get a drink. You're not like them anyway. Who are you kidding? You always drink. And I got to leave Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not leaving AA because God doesn't exist. And I'm not leaving AA because the 12 steps don't work. And I'm not leaving AA because there isn't good sponsorship. I'm leaving AA because I have a mental obsession beyond my human power that's going to drive me back to the desperate experiment of the first drink because I can't take the way I feel when I'm sober. I got nothing in the tank. I'm broken in half. I have no strength left. I can't get my eyes off of my shoes. I don't have any choice. I gotta go. And I caught a break. Because over in the corner were two good members of Alcoholics Anonymous named Lou and Mark. And Lou and Mark, the way they tell the story, they saw me. And Lou said to Mark, whoa. And Mark said to Lou, yeah. And it's the most important moment of my life. Whether I live or die is going to be decided in the next few minutes. But for Mark and Lou, it was Tuesday. And Mark and Lou were where they were every Tuesday night. They were hanging out between the 6 o'clock and the 8 o'clock meeting at the Simi Valley Alano Club. And they were drinking coffee and they had their eyes trained on the room and they had their eyes trained on the door. And they were looking for men to 12-step. And that's what they were doing that night, what they did every Tuesday night. And they took an action that I believe is the most important action that we can take in Alcoholics Anonymous. Two good members of AA took a 30-foot journey across a clubhouse to cordially welcome a man to Alcoholics Anonymous who is dying from the disease of alcoholism. Hi, my name is Lou. This is Mark. We don't think we've met you. Why don't you come sit with us? It sounds like such a niceness, such a politeness. Why do I think it's so important? 30 feet for Mark and Lou? For me, it's a million miles. I can't make it. Don't you know where I've gone, what I've done, who I've hurt? Don't you understand? I got nothing left in the tank. You expect me to shake hands? Nah, Mark and Lou understood the terms of engagement for recovery from alcoholism. They would have to carry the message to the alcoholic that still suffers. And they sat me down on the table and they got me a half a cup of coffee. And Lou continued to stand, and Mark sat down with me, and Lou clapped me in the back and said, "Don, this is Mark. He'll be your sponsor." And he walked away. And they assigned me my first sponsor, an Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that's not done many places, but in my case, it's a good idea, because we say things to our new friends that are crackers. We just say them to them because it was said to us. One of the craziest things we say to people is, find somebody that has what you want. Huh. I wonder what I want my second night of the Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, I don't know, maybe a pharmaceutical rep with a spare Cadillac? Because I'd have never picked the weenie boy they assigned to me, you know what I mean? Because he's everything I'm not, you know what I mean? He's clean cut, he's soft spoken, he's clear eyed, and woo, he loves God. I mean, I hear stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous where people go, "You know, I don't talk to the new man about God until he gets his feet underneath him." My sponsor did not get that memo. I'm telling you. I mean, our first meeting together, he was talking about what God did for him, what God did for her, what God did for them, what God was going to do for me. He was expecting a miracle. We were the lucky ones. I'm at the low point of my existence, and he's telling me I'm one of the lucky ones. And I got to tell you, for some weird reason, I believed him. I mean, I'm sitting there in my wardrobe with all my problems, and it wasn't what he said. It was how he said it. He was sufficiently armed with facts about himself. You know, he had had a spiritual awakening, and he was waiting to give it away that night. He couldn't wait to tell people the good news about what had happened to him. And when he got a new man in front of him, he didn't hold back. And he told me it was available to me. And it wasn't the words he used, it was the delivery that he gave. It was the spiritual enthusiasm behind the message, because you can't defeat spiritual enthusiasm. I was at the low point of my existence, couldn't get my eyes off my shoes, hated myself and everybody else. But that man came at me with that love and that spiritual enthusiasm, and it lifted up my spirit without my permission. And then he started taking liberties with me that I don't recall him asking to. He got a meeting directory and started circling the meetings I'd be going to in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the way I know that, he said, "These are the meetings you'll be going to in Alcoholics Anonymous." And he was talking about God, and he's talking about his sponsor, and he's talking about what we do, you know. And at one point he stopped. He said, "Are you working?" I said, "No, I'm currently unemployed." More circling, more circling. And here's the funny thing about AA too, you know. When I told him I wasn't working, he said, "Oh, great." Nowhere on the planet when somebody goes, "Hey, what do you do for a living?" "Well, I'm currently unemployed." "Oh, I'm so sorry." "Well, I'm sure you'll find a job soon." "Not in AA." We go, "Good, nothing between you and recovery. No big job, no big ego. Good, good." Because the worse you are around here when you're new, the more we like you. You're broken. Ah, oh, you're dying. This is going to be terrific. Oh, you have hallucinations. Even better, even better. Oh, my God. But we understand, man, if you ain't had enough, you ain't had enough. You know what I mean? It's not a problem for me till it's a problem for me. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was ready for a new experience. You know what I mean? Because, I mean, and God, my sponsor, God, he was so good, man. I tried to talk to him about my big deals. You know, I'm in trouble. I got warrants for my arrest. I owe the IRS $80,000. I haven't worked in close to a year. I'm living at my sister's house. I don't have a car. I've never had a checking account. I'm an alcoholic slash loser, you know. And he'd say, "These are your problems?" I go, "Yeah. I think they're fairly significant." He'd go, "No, you're wrong. You're wrong, Don. Because those are situations. You only got one problem. That's that you got a thing called alcoholism. That means you've got something vicious that wants to kill you slowly and take a large bite out of anyone that has the misfortune of caring about a loser like you. And we'll let you know when these other things are a problem." And what I heard was I didn't have to pay back the IRS. Found out I was wrong. But man, my sponsor knew I had something. You know, I had something so valuable when I'm new. Ooh. It's the most valuable commodity a newcomer can have when they're new. It's so precious. I don't have it anymore, man. I don't have it anymore, but I had it in buckets when I was new, right? But no newcomer recognizes its value, because just like me, it kept me up at night. It seemed to be made up of my My guilt, my shame and remorse, those things I'd pushed down with all that whiskey are bubbling to the top and I can't sleep. And it turns out that this precious commodity is something around here we call desperation. And it turns out that that desperation is actually the propellant that takes somebody through the steps. But like any propellant you can think of, you don't have an inexhaustible supply. So you got to ask yourself when you're working with new people, how much propellant do they have? 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, how much do they have? Because the game around here that we play is you bet your life. And we've all sponsored people, and we all know the moment they ran out of propellant, don't we? Because the day before it was like, hey man, can you show up at 6 o'clock, help me set up that meeting? You bet, sponsor, anything for you. 2 days later, hey man, can you show up on Friday, help me set up that meeting? Why are you always asking me? What, don't you sponsor anybody else? And I always think the same thing. Damn, they ran out of propellant. But my sponsor knew I had that propellant. He wasn't going to have me wasting it. He got me busy in Alcoholics Anonymous, all three sides of the triangle, Unity, Service, and Recovery. He got me busy in the steps. And more importantly, he started teaching me how to be an AA member, how to have respect for Alcoholics Anonymous, how to conduct myself in the meeting. Because I'm a street guy, man. I didn't know. You know, because in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's dog rules, right? It's dog rules. You don't know you've done something wrong until an old timer has the guts and the courage to point it out to you in a loving, kind manner and say, kid, we don't do that here, right? You know, and my sponsor was willing to do that for me because seemingly for my first 30 days, I discovered that there's a long list of rules unwritten in any AA literature passed down from old timer to old timer over the generations that they just share freely with new men. Because after the meeting, he'd give me that crooked finger, and I'd think, what did I do now? I would say something out loud in a meeting, and the whole meeting would look at my sponsor. The silent communication of the old-timers. That was, are you going to handle this, or am I? My sponsor would give them the nod. And I knew my goose was cooked. And I'd find out there's things we don't do in AA meetings. Don, if you don't like what they're sharing, you can't go in the corner and do push-ups. Don, you can't get up 6 times during the meeting to get coffee. Don, if you don't like what an old-timer says, you can't threaten to take his life and make amends later. Don, because it's dog rules, man. You don't know until they tell you. Listen, man, I got a dog. Bo the Wonder Dog, 8 years old, he's an amazing dog. You spend 5 minutes with my dog, right? 5 minutes, and you'll say, that's an amazing dog you have there. But like any dog you can think of, Bo at one time was a puppy, right? And I remember when Bo was a couple of months old, I'm on the phone with one of my sponsees, and here comes Bo into my vision in the living room. I remember thinking, oh, there's Bo. Oh, I love that little guy. And then he went into a crouch, you know what I mean? And I said to the phone, I go, oh, no. And my sponsee goes, what is it? I go, ah, Bo's taking a dump in the living room. He goes, do you have to go? I go, no, it's too late, man. You can't interrupt him. You're traumatizing him. You know what I mean? No, you got to watch him. You got to kind of stalk him. And when he breaks bad, then you got to grab him. You know, when he looks like he's about to do it, it will freak him out a little bit because he'll be like, I'm in the air, I'm in the air, I'm in the air. You know, and you rush him outside and you drop him down on the lawn and then you just look at him and he'll look at you with all honesty and go, what the hell was that about? Then he'll realize he's outside. Oh, I'm outside. I might as well go to the bathroom. And if he goes to the bathroom, man, you better throw a party, right? Hooray, Bo! What a good boy! Who's a good boy? And he'll get all excited. He'll be like, dude, I did not know. You want me to poop out here? We do exactly the same thing with our new friends in AA. Shoulder to shoulder, sharing experience, strength, and hope. Not domination, but being willing to take the time to tell people and teach people how to be. I'll tell you, I heard something in a meeting the other day. It sounded really spiritual, and it just offended the crap out of me. He said, we do not teach in Alcoholics Anonymous. We share our experience, strength, and hope. And I went, man, they taught me everything. They taught me how to go to work. They taught me how to be in a relationship. They taught me how to pay my taxes. They taught me how to get out of trouble. They taught me how to show up at court. They taught me how to say I'm sorry. They taught me how to make amends. Everything I do in my life today, the 150 things I do with no fanfare, with no conscious effort, because I've been doing them for so long, I could not do when I got here. And this is the truth. Things don't happen if nobody doesn't take the time to care. And maybe you'll be lucky. Maybe you'll be like me. Maybe you'll get to one day, you'll get to walk into your home group and you'll have the experience I've had 1,000 times. And you'll walk in and there'll be a new guy with 2 weeks and he'll be in the back making coffee and you'll go, oh my God, Jimmy's making coffee. Jimmy couldn't even talk 2 weeks ago. He's making coffee. I'm not drinking the coffee, but he's making it. And then you'll turn your head and there'll be some beautiful young girl, man, that had her eyes on the floor and cried through the whole meeting. And now she's laughing with two other girls and she's putting the literature out. She's got 40 days sobriety. Look at her. She's got friends and she's putting the literature out. She's 45 minutes early to the meeting. She's found a home and you've got to lift your spirit. And then maybe you'll see the thing that just lifts me up so much. You'll see one of our newer friends cordially welcome a new man to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, the way I was welcomed to AA. Welcome, I don't think we've met. My name is Billy, welcome to our meeting. Why don't you come sit with us? And the chain remains unbroken. And it's all I can do not to jump up in the air and go, hooray, newcomer, who's a newcomer? Who's a good newcomer? Who's a good newcomer? Because we don't care how broken you are when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous. We'll bring whatever you got. We'll put it into service. You got stuff to offer. You just don't know it. I remember owing the IRS $80,000. I felt terrible about that. Terrible about it. And my sponsor, man, he was like, you know how old-timers are. They understand. I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, self-seeking, self-delusion, and self-pity. Any one of those can kill me. You put them together, they're lethal, right? So we will not tolerate self-pity in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not because we're harsh. It's not because we don't care. We just know it kills drunks. Because it becomes our excuse for a life poorly lived, and it's just not our fault, and that way we don't have to do anything about it. My sponsor laughed about my debt. In fact, he put it into service in Alcoholics Anonymous immediately. For the next 5 years, if any newcomer had the audacity to complain about his little $1,200 IRS debt, my sponsor would go, Jimmy, hold that thought. Hey, Don, you got a minute? And I'd walk up and he'd go, Don, tell Jimmy how much you owe the IRS. And I'd turn to Jimmy, I go, I owe the IRS $80,000. And Jimmy'd go, Jesus. And I go, just want to be a service. And, you know. And if somebody came to me today and said, Don, you got a really good life. That AA's really blessed you, man. What do you attribute it to? Is it strong sponsorship? Is it a loving God that you found here? Is it the 12 steps? Is it all the service work you've done, the service structure exposure? What is it, Don? I'd say, man, I was willing to be wrong. That's all. Doesn't sound like much, but it's hard to be an alcoholic, man. We go to the grave defending things that are insane. We are delusional. I hate being wrong. When I'm new, I go to my sponsor and I was so sure I was right. And he'd go, that's okay, kid, you're just wrong. And I'd want to punch him, wrong, I can't be wrong. And today when I find out I'm wrong, I get excited. I get happy because you know what? Now I can change. You cannot change without first being wrong about something that at one time you thought you were right about. Being wrong is the essential ingredient, but it has to be self-recognized. It cannot be pointed out by others. It has to be felt in your soul. When you look in the mirror, it's a beautiful day. It's a beautiful day when an alcoholic looks in the mirror and says, I am so tired of being you. And as bad as that feels, we don't know that that's when hope is born in step 6 and 7. That's when we can really go to God in a humble manner, when we can really access that power. And I was wrong about, my sponsor started teaching me that immediately. How did he do it? You see, I know this is unique, but as a newcomer, I had a big deal every day. Every day. I'm wearing my sponsor out. Ooh, 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 sponsor, ooh, ooh, ooh. Listen to what happened today, ooh, ooh, ooh. And he's like, oh my God, here he comes. I wonder what he did now. And finally, I wore him out. And one day he goes, that's it. That 72-hour rule. And I go, what's the 72-hour rule? He goes, for the next 72 hours, you're not allowed to talk to me about it or anybody else about it, not even your friends about it. You can't even pray about it. It doesn't exist. You just set it aside. And if it's still a problem in 72 hours, I'll give you an action to take. Well, you know what happened. He started to teach me I was wrong about that stuff. Because most of the time in 72 hours, guess what? I forgot about it. I remember one time I was really prone to want to kill people when I was new. I came up to him. I was telling him about the latest guy I was going to kill. I'm going to kill him. And he said, 72-hour rule. And I got all pissed off at my sponsor. I said, you don't understand. In 72 hours, I won't be pissed anymore. Completely missing the point of the exercise. But I'm a big believer in strong sponsorship. Every good thing I have in my life today is a result of strong sponsorship. The good marriage I have. I remember I started dating my wife, Eileen. And man, I fell for Eileen hard, like throwing a boulder out of a boat. You know what I mean? I sank right to the bottom. And we were going out about 2 months. And I called my sponsor up and said, hey man, can I come over and talk to you about my relationship? Because sponsors like that. Oh, you want to come over and talk about your relationship? Good. You come over and talk. I'll load my pistol. Go ahead. Oh, really? Then what did she say? You know. And I went over and I told him, I said, I need to break up with Eileen. And he said, why? What's wrong? I go, nothing. She's perfect. And he goes, well, if she's perfect, why are you going to break up with her? I said, can't take it. Can't take the pressure. I'm too in love, man. I just can't handle it. I like it when they're into me, not when I'm into them. This is not working for me. And he called me a bad name and told me I could not break up with my girlfriend. And I said, you can't tell me I can't break up with my girlfriend. He goes, well, I just did. And he walked away because that's the way he's sponsored. And he was an example guy. You know what I mean? My sponsor was. And you know, this June, you know, end of this month, we'll celebrate, 23 years of a beautiful marriage, man. I'd have missed the whole thing. Because I went, you know, and I remember my sponsor telling me to go to court, you know, and I remember thinking, why is he taking me to court? I mean, I had a day off from work. I'm 4 months sober. He goes, we're going to go to court. And I remember thinking, they don't even know where I'm at. Why would I do that? And he said something stupid about, like, if you're going to live sober, you got to live free. I don't know. I didn't get it. And I'm trying to think what I did to piss my sponsor off, because I know I'm going to jail. And to add insult to injury, when he picked me up the next morning, he was in the best mood I'd ever seen him in. He's whistling and grinning at me, and we're going to court. I haven't slept all night because I know I'm going to jail. And at one point, he says this. He goes, you know, Don, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was in a great deal of trouble. Now you're in trouble. I got to say, this is better. And I went into that situation and came out of that situation, and I didn't go to jail. I didn't skate. I had to pay a lot of money back. I had to do an obscene amount of community service. But you know, it was a bit of information that you get to carry with you. When you're wrong about something, you go, you know what? Maybe I don't know everything about everything. And you get to put that in your pocket, and you get to walk a little bit. And I'll tell you, after 27 years, my pockets are bulging out with examples of how I'm wrong, and my life gets better every time I'm wrong. I remember getting into the roofing industry and sales, and I'd never done sales before. And I was terrible at this job, right? And they were sliding me $500 a week against commissions I don't have. And after 3 months of working at this company, I owed the company $5,000. And I remember calling my sponsor going, hey man, we need to cut and run. And he was like, what does your boss say? He goes, my boss is happy with my efforts, and my sponsor wouldn't let me quit that job. And I'm reading sales books at night, right? Every sales book I can get my hand on, because I don't know what I'm doing. But because I'm reading different books, I'm a different salesman every day. So I'm neurotic and psychotic. I don't know who I am, right? I'm the hard sell, soft sell, friendly sell, kill you sell. I don't know what I am. And man, I hit the bottom. I hit the bottom on this one day. I went in and I met this lady, nice lady. We talk. I go up on a roof. I measure a roof. I come down. Everything's going good. And I've been reading this book. And in the book, they had a thing called instant identification. You got 30 seconds to identify with your prospective client. You know, look for a clue. If they got a fish in the wall, what a coincidence. I'm a fisherman. They got a dog. I love dogs. They got a nice garden. I love gardening. So I'm looking for clues with this woman. I can't find any. And finally, I see it. I go, oh, how far along are you? And everything was going so good. And her whole face changed. And she said, what do you mean? Now, a normal person drops the shovel and quits digging, right? But I'm an alcoholic. I can't stop. I'm like, well, you're pregnant, aren't you? And she says, no. And I could hear my sponsor in my head going, drop the shovel, kid. Drop the shovel. But I can't do it. Did you have a kid recently? She says, 2 years ago. I said, thank you for the opportunity to earn your business. I went back to my truck. I'm banging my head on the steering wheel. Stupid, stupid, stupid. I am literally crying. I have tears rolling down my cheeks when I call my sponsor and I tell him what I've done. And now he's crying with tears rolling down his cheeks because he's laughing so hard. And through his laughter, he says, promise me one thing. Promise me you tell nobody at the meeting tonight this story till I'm there. I want to see their faces. My sponsor wouldn't let me quit that job, and I've been now working in that industry doing what I'm doing now for over 20 years, and I've made a really good living at it. And here's the most important thing. I really like what I do for a living, and I'm really good at it. And it was that I was wrong about it. And I've been wrong about everything. I've been wrong about a lot of stuff. And in my marriage, I had to learn to be wrong before my marriage got better. I remember years ago going up to my wife. I'd heard this goofy exercise, and I went up to her, and I said, honey, on a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate me? She had a number immediately. It was not the number I was thinking of. And so I said, well, if I actually am a 6, how would I get to be a 7? She had an answer for that too. No thought. And she said, it would be nice if you looked at me when I talked to you. And I remembered my intellectual reaction to that was, I look at you when you talk to me, but I was playing nice. I said, well, I'll work on that. A couple days later, we're on the couch and she's talking to me. She hits about the 2-minute mark and talking, and my head starts to move. You know what I mean? I got to grab my head to hold it back and I start flying. I'm telling you, I would have rather looked at the blazing sun with naked eyes than continue to look at my wife. And I thought to myself, if I'm this wrong about that, what else am I wrong about? Everything. Right? And so we have to embrace the power of being wrong, being open-minded, and realize that a solitary self-appraisal is insufficient, like it says in the 5th step. We have to ask our sponsors, how are we doing? We have to ask our employers, how are we doing? We have to ask our significant others, how are we doing? And not be afraid of the answer. Because I will never see myself clearly. I can't get to where I need to get alone. I have to have the help of the people I'm in this with. It's just logical. I'm going to tell you a quick story and sit down. 2004, my wife and I moved to the Great Pacific Northwest, Bellingham, Washington, 100 miles north of Seattle, 20 miles south of the Canadian border, America's first defense against Canada, I suppose. And we're city kids, man. We're concrete, steel, and glass, you know what I mean? And suddenly we're in 150-foot trees and deer, and it's wildlife, and we're just not used to it. And I mean, it's dark at night. It's darkity dark, dark. I mean, the first time I forgot something in the car and I went out to it and I didn't have a flashlight and I didn't have a porch light on, I got about halfway to the car and a little voice in my head said, cougar. And I just jumped up in the air and ran in the house and slammed the door. My wife's like, what's with you? And I'm going, don't go out there. Dark, darkity dark, dark. Don't. And we got wildlife where we live, like I said, and we got a ton of deer, man. And the first summer we're there, all the mama deers are bringing their baby deers in there, and we freaked out. Because we're city kids, right? And we're like, oh my God, there's baby deer! If you need 20,000 pictures of a baby deer, just see me after the meeting. And we fell in love with this one little boy deer because he had a big scar across his face, man, and he was real inquisitive and really courageous. He'd run right up to you and run away. And so because we're city kids, we're naming the deer. That's Mama Deer and Scratch, Mama Deer and Scratch. You know what I mean? And then rutting season comes in the fall, and the deer start to lose their summer coats and put on their heavier winter coats, but not Scratch. Scratch starts to look crappy, you know what I mean? His fur gets all patchy, he's losing hair everywhere. And I mentioned it to Eileen, like, Scratch is looking kind of ugly. And she goes, yeah, but she's like that girl. So she gets on the internet and researches it and reports back to me that it's an actual affliction they get in their first year, deer hair loss. And if they get it bad enough, they'll lose all their fur, and then winter will come. And they won't be able to eat enough to keep their furnace going. And they'll get hypothermic, and they'll die. And I said to Eileen, I go, Scratch is going to die? And she goes, yeah. I go, not on our watch. And we lost our mind, and we started breaking every wildlife preservation law in the state of Washington, you know what I mean? We're setting up supplemental feeding stations in our backyard. And, you know, when you do that, you can't feed the one sick deer. So now we got 20 deer coming from all over. There's my wife, 5'3", maybe, and she's out in the middle of these deer chasing off 150-pound bucks, yelling at them, you're selfish, you're self-centered, let the sick one eat, get out of here. I'm on the porch taking cover, be careful, honey. And it's not helping, man, it's not helping. He's getting worse and worse, and it got so bad that finally Scratch was completely bald, and all he had left was a 2-inch wide, 2-inch high swatch of fur from the nap of his neck all the way to his rump. And we've been overfeeding him, right? So now he's this fat, rounded out like a beer keg, ugly, dying, mohawk, newcomer deer. Just sits in my backyard and eats and poops. And I'm obsessed with this deer. I'd go to work and I'd call Eileen and I'd say, did Scratch show up? And she'd go, yeah. I go, how does he look? She'd go, not good. And I'd shake my fist at God. Not this one, God. You don't get this one. And we make it to spring and Scratch doesn't die. And for the next 3 or 4 years, he'd show up in the fall with the other big bucks and walk into our backyard, this magnificent buck. We knew it was him because of the scar. And now he was huge and he was strong. He had this great rack and he'd walk right up to Eileen and Eileen would feed him apples by hand. And I'd watch that and I'd think to myself, what was it about that damn baby deer that made me lose my mind? And one day it hit me. I'm that baby deer. I'm that newcomer in the Simi Valley Alano Club with my back against the wall, wearing my sunglasses at night, that anyone with a glancing familiarity about alcoholism would have taken one look at me and said, that guy over there, he's going to die. And two good members of Alcoholics Anonymous saw the exact same thing and said, not on our watch. And it, yeah. And they did what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm telling you, we all had a wonderful weekend. You know, we've all become rejuvenated. We've all celebrated sobriety. But we are going to leave here. We're going to go back to our respective home groups. And the question we have to ask ourselves is, what are we going to do when our new friends show up? Because they are coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. They don't even know it yet. They're finishing up their stories. But they are coming to Alcoholics Anonymous the way that we came. Hopeless, helpless, and hapless. Looking for something. Knowing it's not going to work in a million years. But they won't have any other choice. And they'll end up in our respective home groups. And we have to ask ourselves, when they show up, where will we be? And more importantly, how will we be? Am I going to be in my home group with my buddies cutting it up, talking about our latest fishing trip, fantasy football, what we're doing that weekend, the next big business deal? Or am I going to leave all that crap in the parking lot where it belongs and realize that we're in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and that stuff has no place in it? Am I going to have my eyes trained on the room and trained on the door like Mark and Lou did for me? You know, I'll go to my meeting tomorrow night like I always do, and it's just another Monday night for me enjoying the gift of sobriety, and I know my friends will be there and my sponsees will be there, and it's just another night for me. But there may be a new guy there, and that might be the most important night of his life. And I'll tell you, man, I show up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a real life and a real job. I work hard. And sometimes I show up at AA, and I'm not ready to go in. I got the whole world hanging all over me. And I'll shut down the truck, and I won't get out. And I'll say a prayer before I walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll say something like this: God, I got the whole world hanging all over me. I got money problems, sex problems, me problems. And it all seems really important. And I don't even want to be here right now, and I know that's selfish and that's self-centered, and I'm ungrateful. Let me leave all my problems right here in the front of this truck. I know you'll take good care of them. Give me eyes to see and a heart to feel. Let me remember that there's men in there that need help. Let me be the kind of A member that was here for me when I showed up. And now I can walk in and I can have my priorities straight. It's not about getting my coffee and getting my seat. It's about shaking hands with everybody in the room, checking in. Go say hi to that guy you never met before. Make sure I'm doing what AA did for me. Because I'm telling you what, Bill and Bob are gone. They can't do us for us. They left us a beautiful legacy. But they're coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're coming looking for us. It's our watch now, and I hope we don't fall down. Thanks for listening.